a public statement like this, which was bound to be politically devastating, when the FBI itself couldn't say whether the new material was important in any way. At the very end of his July 5th press conference, Comey had declared sanctimoniously, "Only facts matter." But here the FBI didn't know the facts and didn't let that stop it from throwing the presidential election into chaos. Comey's actions were condemned swiftly by former Justice Department officials of both parties, including Republican Attorneys General Alberto Gonzalez and Michael Mukasey, the latter of whom said that Comey stepped way outside his job. The Department of Justice's Inspector General also opened an investigation into Comey's conduct. Before Comey sent his letter, Justice Department officials reminded Comey's deputies of the long-standing policy to avoid any activity that could be viewed as influencing an election. According to reporting by the New York Times, they also said there was no need to inform Congress before the FBI determined if the emails were pertinent. A member of Comey's team at the FBI also raised concerns. If Comey had waited until after the FBI had reviewed the emails, he would have learned quickly that there was no new evidence. Comey sent his letter anyway. The result, according to Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein, was so damaging that, quote, "The FBI is unlikely to regain public and congressional trust until it has a director who understands the gravity of the mistakes and pledges never to repeat them," unquote. So why did Comey do it? In a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on March 3, 2017, Comey testified that he saw only two choices, speak or conceal. But as Rosenstein noted in his memo, conceal is a loaded term that misstates the issue. When federal agents quietly open a criminal investigation, we are not concealing anything. We are simply following the long-standing policy that we refrain from publicizing non-public information. In that context, silence is not concealment. I can't know what was in Comey's head. I don't know if he had anything against me personally, or if he thought I was going to win the election and worried that if he didn't speak out, he'd later be attacked by Republicans or his own agents. What I do know, though, is that when you're the head of an agency as important as the FBI, you have to care a lot more about how things really are than how they look, and you have to be willing to take the heat that goes along with the big job. Whatever Comey was feeling or fearing, there is reason to be concerned about what was going on inside the FBI. Quote, "There's a revolution going on inside the FBI, and it's now at a boiling point," unquote. Rudy Giuliani on Fox News, October 26, 2016. According to Rudy and others with close ties to the FBI, there was a vocal faction within the Bureau that was livid that in their view, Comey had, quote, "let me off the hook," unquote, in July. Quote, "the agents are furious," unquote, Jim Kallstrom, the former head of the FBI's New York office and a close ally of the ex-New York mayor, told the press. Kallstrom also endorsed Trump and described me as a pathological liar and member of a crime family. Kallstrom claimed to be in touch with hundreds of FBI agents, both retired and current. "The FBI is Trump land," is how another agent put it. The agent said I was regarded by some as the Antichrist personified. The New York Post reported that FBI agents are ready to revolt. There was a rash of leaks designed to damage my campaign, including the quickly debunked false claim that indictments were coming relating to the Clinton Foundation. Then Rudy, one of Trump's top surrogates, went on Fox News on October 26 and promised, quote, "a surprise or two that you're going to hear about in the next 2 days," unquote. It was just 2 days later that Comey sent his letter. On November 4th, Rudy was back on Fox News and confirmed that he had advance warning. Quote, "Did I hear about it? You're darn right I heard about it," unquote, he said. At the same time, he tried to backpedal on his statement. Several months later, Comey was questioned about this in that same Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. "Did anybody in the FBI during this 2016 campaign have contact with Rudy Giuliani about the Clinton investigation?" asked Senator Pat Leahy of Vermont. Comey said it was a matter the FBI is looking into, and that he was very, very interested to learn the truth. Quote, "I don't know yet, but if I find out that people were leaking information about our investigations, whether to reporters or private parties, there will be severe consequences," unquote, Comey said. This is a crucial question that must be answered. Comey owes it to the American people to say whether anyone at the FBI inappropriately provided Giuliani, Kallstrom, or anyone else with information. The Bureau's new leaders and the Justice Department Inspector General have a responsibility to investigate this matter fully and ensure accountability. It's galling that Comey took pains during the same period to avoid saying anything at all about the investigation into possible connections between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence. This double standard has still never been explained adequately, and it leaves me astonished. The final week of the 2016 campaign was dominated by swirling questions about my emails and talk that the prayers of Trump supporters might finally be answered and I'd somehow wind up in prison. After 9 days of turmoil, 9 days in which millions of Americans went to the polls to vote early, and just 36 hours before Election Day, Comey sent another letter announcing that the new batch of emails wasn't really new and contained nothing to cause him to alter his months-old decision not to seek charges. Well, great. Too little, too late. The rest is history. There is one more angle worth considering before I turn the page on this sordid chapter, the role of the press. Quote, "The ongoing normalization of Trump is the most disorienting development of the presidential campaign, but the most significant may be the abnormalization of Clinton," unquote. Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine, September 22, 2016. Abnormalization is a pretty good description of how it felt to live through the maelstrom of the email controversy. According to Harvard's Shorenstein Center, over the entire election, negative reports about me swamped positive coverage by 62% to 38%. For Trump, however, it was a more balanced 56% negative to 44% positive. Coverage of my emails crowded out virtually everything else my campaign said or did. The press acted like it was the only story that mattered. To take just one egregious example, by September 2015, the then Washington Post political reporter, Chris Saliza, had already written at least 50 pieces about my emails. A year later, the Post editorial board realized the story was out of control. Quote, "Imagine how history would judge today's Americans if, looking back at this election, the record showed that voters empowered a dangerous man because of a minor email scandal," they wrote in a September 2016 editorial. No need to imagine. It happened. The Post went on, quote, "There is no equivalence between Ms. Clinton's wrongs and Mr. Trump's manifest unfitness for office," unquote. That was one of many editorials and endorsements that got it right. I was glad to be endorsed by nearly every newspaper in the country, including some that hadn't backed a Democrat in decades, if ever. Unfortunately, I don't think many undecided voters read editorials, and they almost never influence broadcast or cable news. It's the political stories on the front page that get read and picked up on TV. So even though some journalists and editors came to regret losing perspective and overdoing the coverage of my emails, and after the election, a few even shared their remorse in confidence, the damage was irreparable. Quote, considered alongside the real challenges that will occupy the next president, that email server, which has consumed so much of this campaign, looks like a matter for the help desk. Unquote. New York Times endorsement of me for president, September 2016. The Times, as usual, played an outsized role in shaping the coverage of my emails throughout the election. To me, the paper's approach felt schizophrenic. It spent nearly 2 years beating me up about emails, but its glowing endorsement applied some sanity to the controversy. Then in the home stretch of the race, when it mattered most, the paper went right back to its old ways. First, it devoted the entire top half of its front page to Comey's October 28th letter, even though there was zero evidence of any wrongdoing and very few facts of any kind, and continued to give it breathless coverage for the rest of the week. Then, on October 31st, the Times ran one of the single worst stories of the entire election, claiming the FBI saw no link between the Trump campaign and Russia. The truth was that a very serious counterintelligence investigation was picking up steam. The paper must have been sold a bill of goods by sources trying to protect Trump. It should have known better than to publish it days before the election. In both cases, it seemed as if speculation and sensationalism trumped sound journalism. The Times was taken to task by its ombudsman for downplaying the seriousness of Russia's meddling. Quote, this is an act of foreign interference in an American election on a scale we've never seen, yet on most days it has been the also-ran of media coverage, wrote Liz Spade on November 5th, 3 days before Election Day. In stark contrast to reporting on my emails, quote, what was missing is a sense that this coverage is actually important, unquote. In a follow-up column in January, Spade noted that the Times knew in September the FBI was investigating the Trump Organization's ties to Russia, possibly including secret warrants from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, yet didn't tell the public. Quote, it's hard not to wonder what impact such information might have had on voters still evaluating the candidates, she wrote. Good question. It gives a whole new meaning to what Bill likes to call majoring in the minors. Over the years, going all the way back to the baseless Whitewater Inquisition, it seemed as if many of those in charge of political coverage at the New York Times have viewed me with hostility and skepticism. They've applied what's sometimes called the Clinton rules. As Charles Pierce put it in Esquire magazine, quote, the Clinton rules state that any relatively commonplace political occurrence or activity takes on mysterious dark energy when any Clinton is involved, unquote. As a result, a lot of journalists see their job as exposing the devious machinations of the secretive Clinton machine. The Times has by no means been the only or even the worst offender, but its treatment has stung the most. I've read the Times for more than 40 years and still look forward to it every day. I appreciate much of the paper's terrific non-Clinton reporting, the excellent op-ed page, and the generous endorsements I've received in every campaign I've ever run. I understand the pressure that even the best political journalists are now under. Negative stories drive more traffic and buzz than positive or even-handed ones. But we're talking about one of the most important news sources in the world, the paper that often sets the tone for everyone else, which means, I think, that it should hold itself to the highest standard. I suppose this mini-rant guarantees that my book will receive a ripper-to-shreds review in the Times, but history will agree that this coverage affected the outcome of the election. Besides, I had to get this off my chest. Quote, "This may shock you. Hillary Clinton is fundamentally honest." Unquote. Former New York Times editor Jill Abramson in The Guardian, March 28, 2016. Jill Abramson, who oversaw years of tough political coverage about me, came to this conclusion by looking at data from the fact-checking organization PolitiFact, which found I told the truth more than any other presidential candidate in 2016, including both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, who was the most dishonest candidate ever measured. The fact that this was seen as surprising says a lot about the corrosive effect of the never-ending email controversy and all the decades of baseless attacks that preceded it. Quote, "But her emails," unquote. The Internet, 2017. The further we've gotten from the election, the more outlandish our excessive national focus on emails has seemed. "But her emails" became a rueful meme used in response to the latest Trump revelations, outrages, and embarrassments. As hard as it is to believe or explain, my emails were the story of 2016. It didn't matter that the State Department Inspector General said there were no laws or regulations prohibiting the use of personal email for official business. It didn't matter that the FBI found no reasonable legal grounds to bring any kind of case. The original decision to use personal email was on me, and I never figured out how to make people understand where I was coming from or convince them that I wasn't part of some devious plot. But it wasn't me who determined how Comey and the FBI handled this issue or how the press covered it. That's on them. Since the election, we've learned that Vice President Mike Pence used private email for official business when he was governor of Indiana, like so many other state and federal officials across our country, including, by the way, many staff in the Bush White House who used a private RNC server for government business and then, quote, lost, unquote, more than 20 million emails. We've learned that Trump's transition team copied highly sensitive documents and removed them from a secure facility. We've learned that members of Trump's White House staff use encrypted messaging apps that seem to evade federal records laws. And we know now that Trump associates are under federal investigation for far more serious things. Yet most of the fulminating critics have gone silent. It's almost as if they never really cared about the proper maintenance of government records or the finer points of retroactive classification, and the whole thing was just a convenient political piñata. The further we get from the election, the stranger it seems that this controversy could swing a national election with such monumental consequences. I picture future historians scratching their heads, trying to understand what happened. I'm still scratching mine, too. When reason fails, the devil helps. Fyodor Dostoevsky. Trolls, bots, fake news, and real Russians. Some people are blessed with a strong immune system. Others aren't as lucky. Their defenses have been worn down by disease or injury, so they're susceptible to all kinds of infections that a healthy person would easily fight off. When that happens to someone you love, it's terrible to watch. The body politic works in much the same way. Our democracy has built-in defenses that keep us strong and healthy, including the checks and balances written into our Constitution. Our founding fathers believed that one of the most important defenses would be an informed citizenry that could make sound judgments based on facts and reason. Losing that is like losing an immune system, leaving a democracy vulnerable to all manner of attack. And a democracy, like a body, cannot stay strong through repeated injuries. In 2016, our democracy was assaulted by a foreign adversary determined to mislead our people, inflame our divisions, and throw an election to its preferred candidate. That attack succeeded because our immune system had been slowly eroded over years. Many Americans had lost faith in the institutions that previous generations relied on for objective information, including government, academia, and the press, leaving them vulnerable to a sophisticated misinformation campaign. There are many reasons why this happened, but one is that a small group of right-wing billionaires, people like the Mercer family and Charles and David Koch, recognized long ago that, as Stephen Colbert once joked, reality has a well-known liberal bias. More generally, the right spent a lot of time and money building an alternative reality. Think of a partisan petri dish where science is denied, lies masquerade as truth, and paranoia flourishes. Their efforts were amplified in 2016 by a presidential candidate who trafficked in dark conspiracy theories drawn from the pages of supermarket tabloids and the far reaches of the internet. A candidate who deflected any criticism by attacking others with made-up facts and an uncanny gift for humiliating zingers. He helped to further blur news and entertainment, reality TV, and reality. As a result, by the time Vladimir Putin came along, our democracy was already far sicker than we realized. Now that the Russians have infected us and seen how weak our defenses are, they'll keep at it. Maybe other foreign powers will join them. They'll also continue targeting our friends and allies. Their ultimate goal is to undermine, perhaps even destroy, Western democracy itself. As the former director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, told Congress, quote, "If there has ever been a clarion call for vigilance and action against a threat to the very foundation of our democratic political system, this episode is it," unquote. This should concern all Americans, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, everyone. We need to get to the bottom of it. The 2016 election may be over, but we have new elections coming up soon. I'm going to lay out what is known in as much detail as I can, so we can try to understand what happened and what we can do to prevent it from happening again. There's a lot we still don't know. Investigations are ongoing, and the story changes daily with breaking news. Trump, his allies, and others have vigorously denied accusations of wrongdoing. You can look at the facts and decide for yourself. But what should be beyond doubt is that foreign interference in our elections is wrong, period. And the threat we face, from without and within, is bigger than one campaign, one party, or one election. The only way to heal our democracy and protect it for the future is to understand the threat and defeat it. V for Vendetta and Vladimir. President Obama once compared Vladimir Putin to a bored kid at the back of the classroom. "He's got that kind of slouch," Obama said. When I sat with Putin in meetings, he looked more like one of those guys in the subway who imperiously spreads their legs wide, encroaching on everyone else's space, as if to say, "I take what I want, and I have so little respect for you that I'm going to act as if I'm lounging at home in my bathrobe." They call it man-spreading. That was Putin. I've dealt with a lot of male leaders in my life, but Putin is in a class by himself. A former KGB spy with a taste for over-the-top macho theatrics and Baroque violence, a public inquiry in the United Kingdom concluded that he probably approved the killing of one of his enemies in London by poisoning his tea with polonium-210, a rare radioactive isotope. Putin has emerged in the popular imagination as an arch-villain straight out of a James Bond movie. Yet he's also perennially misunderstood and underestimated. George W. Bush famously said that after looking Putin in the eye, he found him very straightforward and trustworthy, and was able to get a sense of his soul. My somewhat tongue-in-cheek response was, he was a KGB agent. By definition, he doesn't have a soul. I don't think Vladimir appreciated that one. Our relationship has been sour for a long time. Putin doesn't respect women and despises anyone who stands up to him, so I'm a double problem. After I criticized one of his policies, he told the press, "It's better not to argue with women," but went on to call me weak. "Maybe weakness is not the worst quality for a woman," he joked. Hilarious. Putin still smolders over what he views as the humiliations of the 1990s, when Russia lost its old Soviet dominions and the Clinton administration presided over NATO's expansion. And things got a lot worse between us during my time as Secretary of State. When President Obama and I came into office in 2009, Putin and his Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, had swapped jobs as a way of thwarting constitutionally required term limits. Surprisingly, Medvedev showed some independence and a willingness to pursue better relations with the United States. We knew Putin was still the real power in Russia, but decided to see if we could find some areas of shared interest where progress might be possible. That was the origin of the much-maligned reset. It led to several concrete successes, including a new nuclear arms control treaty, new sanctions on Iran and North Korea, a much-needed supply route to equip our troops in Afghanistan, increased trade and investment, and expanded counterterrorism cooperation. In the spring of 2011, President Medvedev agreed to abstain on the UN Security Council resolution authorizing the use of force to protect civilians in Libya from the dictator, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, a decision that angered Putin. President Obama and I agreed that seeking pragmatic cooperation with Russia on certain issues was not inconsistent with also standing up for our values and showing support for the democratic aspirations of the Russian people. I felt a responsibility to speak out against the Kremlin's repression of human rights in Russia, especially the intimidation and murder of journalists and political opponents. In October 2009, I was in Moscow and did an interview with one of the last remaining independent radio stations in the country. I expressed support for human rights and civil society, and I said that I thought a lot of Russians wanted the thugs who attacked journalists brought to justice. I knew Putin wouldn't be happy with me saying these things on his own turf, but I felt that if the United States accepted a gag order on these issues, that decision would reverberate not just in Russia, but also around the world. The KGB taught Putin to be suspicious of everyone. Russia's troubles in the 1990s and the quote, color revolutions, unquote, of the 2000s, the string of popular revolts that toppled authoritarian regimes in several former Soviet bloc countries, took him from suspicious to paranoid. He came to view popular dissent as an existential threat. When he heard me and other Western leaders voice support for civil society in Russia, he saw it as a plot to undermine him. For Putin, a pivotal moment came in 2011. In September, he announced he would run for president again. In December, there were widespread reports of fraud in parliamentary elections, which sparked domestic protests and international condemnation. At a conference in Lithuania focused on promoting democracy and human rights in Europe, I expressed America's concerns. The Russian people, like people everywhere, deserve the right to have their voices heard and their votes counted, I said. And that means they deserve fair, free, transparent elections and leaders who are accountable to them. Tens of thousands of Russians took to the streets amid chants of "Putin is a thief," an unprecedented popular challenge to his iron grip on the country. Putin, more paranoid than ever, thought it was a conspiracy orchestrated from Washington. He blamed me in particular, saying I, quote, gave them a signal, unquote. Putin quashed the protests and once again became president, but he was now running scared and seething with anger. In the fall of 2011, Putin had published an essay promising to regain Russia's regional and global influence. I read it as a plan to re-Sovietize the lost empire and said so publicly. Once back in office, Putin moved to put his vision into action. He consolidated power and cracked down on any remaining domestic dissent. He also took a more combative tone toward the West and nursed his personal grudge against me. By the way, that's not just how I saw it. Grudge is also the word the U.S. government used in its official assessment. In a series of memos, I warned President Obama that things were changing in Russia and America would have to take a harder line with Putin. Our relationship was likely to get worse before it got better, I told the president, and we needed to make it clear to Putin that aggressive actions would have consequences. There's a bear in the woods. During Obama's second term, when I was out of office, things did indeed go from bad to worse. When popular protests in Ukraine forced the country's corrupt pro-Moscow leader to flee, Putin swung into action. He launched an operation to subvert and seize Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, a vacation destination for wealthy Russians. That was followed by further efforts to destabilize eastern Ukraine, home to many ethnic Russians, eventually leading to a protracted civil war. Watching from the sidelines, I was struck by the sophistication of the operation. It was much more effective than Russia's 2008 invasion of Georgia. Nationalist propaganda on television, radio, and social media radicalized ethnic Russians, while cyber attacks muzzled opposing voices. Undercover Russian paramilitary special forces swept into Crimea to organize protests, seize buildings, and intimidate or co-opt Ukrainian officials. Meanwhile, the Kremlin denied it all, despite the fact that the whole world could see photos of Russian soldiers carrying Russian weapons, driving Russian vehicles, and speaking with Russian accents. Putin called them indigenous self-defense groups. Ukrainians called them little green men. Once the occupation was a fait accompli, the Russians staged a rigged referendum to give themselves a patina of popular sovereignty and then annexed the peninsula, formally making it part of Russia. The Russians did one other thing which didn't get enough attention at the time, but in retrospect was a sign of things to come. In early 2014, they released on Twitter and YouTube what they claimed was an audio recording of a private conversation between two veteran American diplomats. Our ambassador to Ukraine, Jeff Pyatt, and my friend and former advisor, Toria Nuland, who was then the top State Department official for Europe. On the Russian tape, Toria used colorful language to express her exasperation about European foot-dragging over Ukraine. Moscow clearly hoped her words would drive a wedge between America and our allies. The incident didn't have lasting diplomatic repercussions, but it did show that the Russians were not just stealing information for intelligence purposes, as all countries do. They were now using social media and strategic leaks to weaponize that information. In the wake of Russia's Ukraine operations, I expressed my concerns to some of my former national security colleagues. Moscow had clearly developed new capabilities in psychological and information warfare and was willing to use them. I was worried the United States and our allies weren't prepared to keep up or respond. I knew that in 2013, one of Russia's top military officers, Valery Gerasimov, had written an article laying out a new strategy for hybrid warfare. In previous generations, the Soviet military had planned to fight large-scale conflicts with massive conventional and nuclear forces. In the 21st century, Gerasimov said the line between war and peace would blur, and Russia should prepare for under-the-radar conflicts waged through propaganda, cyber attacks, paramilitary operations, financial and energy manipulation, and covert subversion. The operations in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, and I would argue the harboring of NSA leaker Edward Snowden, proved that Putin was putting Gerasimov's theory into practice. Sometimes these tactics are called active measures. Thomas Ridd, a professor of security studies at King's College London, offered a good primer and testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee in March 2017. Quote, active measures are semi-covert or covert intelligence operations to shape an adversary's political decisions, he explained. The tried and tested way of active measures is to use an adversary's weaknesses against himself, unquote. And the rise of the Internet and social media has created many new opportunities. As Senator Sheldon Whitehouse put it, the Russians have been at this for a long time, and now they've adapted old methods to new technologies, making use of social media, malware, and complex financial transactions. I was also alarmed to see Russian money, propaganda, or other support aiding right-wing nationalist parties across Europe, including Marine Le Pen's National Front in France, Alternative for Germany, AFD, and Austria's Freedom Party. According to the Washington Post, the Kremlin has also cultivated leaders of right-wing American organizations such as the NRA, the National Organization for Marriage, and individuals like the evangelist Franklin Graham. Putin has positioned himself as the leader of an authoritarian, xenophobic international movement that wants to expel immigrants, break up the European Union, weaken the Atlantic Alliance, and roll back much of the progress achieved since World War II. People laugh when Putin has himself photographed riding horses shirtless, winning judo matches, and driving race cars. But the macho stunts are part of a strategy. He has made himself an icon to traditionalists everywhere who resent their increasingly open, diverse, and liberal societies. That's why he formed a close alliance with the Russian Orthodox Church, passed vicious anti-gay laws, and decriminalized domestic violence. It's all about projecting an image of traditional masculinity, Christian morality, and white nationalist purity and power. During the campaign, I asked my team to start working on a more aggressive, strategic approach toward Russia. I didn't want to be dragged into a new Cold War, but the best way to avoid conflict and keep the door open for future cooperation would be to send Putin a message of strength and resolve on day one. It's been said that he subscribes to Vladimir Lenin's old adage, probe with bayonets. If you encounter mush, proceed. If you encounter steel, withdraw. I wanted to be sure that when Putin looked to America, he saw steel, not mush. I wanted to go further than the Obama administration, which resisted providing defensive arms to the Ukrainian government or establishing a no-fly zone in Syria, where Putin had launched a military intervention to prop up the murderous dictator Bashar al-Assad. I also intended to increase our investment in cybersecurity and pursue an all-hands-on-deck effort to secure cooperation between the government and the private sector on protecting vital national and commercial infrastructure from attacks, including nuclear power plants electrical grids, dams, and the financial system. All of this is to say that I had my eyes open. I knew Putin was a growing threat. I knew he had a personal vendetta against me and deep resentment toward the United States. Yet I never imagined that he would have the audacity to launch a massive covert attack against our own democracy right under our noses, and that he'd get away with it. Since the election, we've learned a lot about the scope and sophistication of the Russian plot, and more information comes to light every day. But even during the campaign, we knew enough to realize that we were facing, in the words of Senator Harry Reid, quote, one of the gravest threats to our democracy since the Cold War, unquote. And it just got worse from there. I won't try to provide you a definitive account of every twist and turn of this saga. There are plenty of other sources for that. But I will try to share what I experienced, how it felt, and what I think we need to do as a nation to protect ourselves for the future. The budding bromance. It was strange from the start. Why did Donald Trump keep blowing kisses to Vladimir Putin? He said he would give Putin an A for leadership and described the Russian president as highly respected within his country and beyond. Trump reveled in reports that Putin had called him brilliant, even though the more accurate translation was colorful. In a particularly telling exchange on MSNBC's Morning Joe, Trump defended Putin's alleged murder of journalists, quote, at least he's a leader, unlike what we have in this country, unquote, Trump said. As if that wasn't bad enough, he added, quote, I think our country does plenty of killing also, unquote. No previous American presidential candidate would ever have dreamt of trashing our country like that, or suggesting moral equivalency between American democracy and Russian autocracy. No wonder Putin liked Trump. What was going on here? I was genuinely puzzled. This was far outside the bounds of normal American politics, especially for a Republican. How is the party of Reagan letting itself become the party of Putin? I thought there were three plausible explanations for the budding Trump-Putin bromance. First, Trump has a bizarre fascination with dictators and strongmen. He praised Kim Jong-un, the murderous young ruler of North Korea, for his skill at consolidating power and eliminating dissent. You've got to give him credit, Trump said. He also talked admiringly about the 1989 Chinese massacre of unarmed student protesters at Tiananmen Square. He said it showed strength. Strength is what it's all about. Trump doesn't think in terms of morality or human rights. He thinks only in terms of power and dominance. Might makes right. Putin thinks the same way, albeit much more strategically. And Trump appears to have fallen hard for Putin's macho, bare-chested autocrat act. He doesn't just like Putin. He seems to want to be like Putin, a white authoritarian leader who could put down dissenters, repress minorities, disenfranchise voters, weaken the press, and amass untold billions for himself. He dreams of Moscow on the Potomac. Second, despite his utter lack of interest in or knowledge of most foreign policy issues, Trump has a long-standing worldview that aligns well with Putin's agenda. He is suspicious of American allies, doesn't think values should play a role in foreign policy, and doesn't seem to believe the United States should continue carrying the mantle of global leadership. Way back in 1987, Trump spent nearly $100,000 on full-page ads in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe criticizing Ronald Reagan's foreign policy and urging America to stop defending allies who should be taking care of themselves. Trump said the world was taking advantage of the United States and laughing at us. Nearly 30 years later, he was saying the same things. He referred to America's alliances as if they were protection rackets, where we could extort weaker countries to pay tribute in exchange for safety. He threatened to abandon NATO and badmouth the European Union. He insulted the leaders of countries such as Britain and Germany. He even got into a Twitter fight with Pope Francis. Given all this, it's no surprise that once he became president, Trump bickered with our allies and refused to commit to the bedrock principle of mutual defense at a NATO summit. America's lost prestige and newfound isolation were embodied in the sad image of the other leaders of Western democracies strolling together down a lovely Italian street, while Trump followed in a golf cart all by himself. All this was music to Putin's ears. The Kremlin's top strategic goal is to weaken the Atlantic Alliance and reduce America's influence in Europe, leaving the continent ripe for Russian domination. Putin couldn't ask for a better friend than Donald Trump. The third explanation was that Trump seems to have extensive financial ties to Russia. In 2008, Trump's son Don Jr. told investors in Moscow, quote, "Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our assets, and we see a lot of money pouring in from Russia," unquote, according to the Russian newspaper Kommersant. In 2013, Trump himself said in an interview with David Letterman that he did, quote, "a lot of business with the Russians," unquote. A respected golf journalist named James Dodson reported that Trump's other son, Eric, told him, quote, "We don't rely on American banks to fund Trump golf projects. We have all the funding we need out of Russia," unquote. Without seeing Trump's tax returns, it's impossible to determine the full extent of these financial ties. Based on what's already known, there is good reason to believe that despite repeated bankruptcies, and even though most American banks refuse to lend to him, Trump, his companies, or partners, according to USA Today, turn to wealthy Russians and oligarchs from former Soviet republics, several allegedly connected to organized crime. This was based on a review of court cases and other legal documents. Additionally, in 2008, Trump raised eyebrows by selling a mansion in Palm Beach to a Russian oligarch at an inflated price, $54 million more than he paid for it just 4 years earlier. In 2013, his Miss Universe pageant in Moscow was partly financed by a billionaire ally of Putin. To build Trump's Soho, New York hotel, he partnered with a company called the Bayrock Group and a Russian immigrant named Felix Sater, formerly linked to the mafia, who was previously convicted of money laundering. USA Today has done great reporting on all of this if you want to learn more. Trump's advisors also had financial ties to Russia. Paul Manafort, whom Trump hired in March 2016 and promoted to campaign chairman 2 months later, was a Republican lobbyist who had spent years serving autocrats overseas, most recently making millions working for pro-Putin forces in Ukraine. Then there was Michael Flynn, the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who had been fired for good cause by President Obama in 2014. Then Flynn accepted money from Putin's Western-facing propaganda network, Russia Today, RT. And in December 2015, attended RT's 10th anniversary gala in Moscow, where he sat at Putin's table along with Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein. There was also Carter Page, a former advisor to the Russian gas giant Gazprom, who traveled back and forth to Moscow frequently, including in July 2016 in the middle of the campaign. He seemed to be reading from the Kremlin's anti-American talking points. Learning all this over the course of 2015 and 2016 was surreal. It felt like we were peeling an onion and there was always another layer. If you add together all these factors, Trump's affection for tyrants and hostility toward allies, sympathy for Russia's strategic aims, and alleged financial ties to shady Russian actors, his pro-Putin rhetoric starts to make sense. And this was all out in the open and well known throughout the campaign. It came to a head in late April 2016 when Trump called for improved relations with Russia in a major foreign policy speech at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington. The Russian ambassador to the United States, Sergei Kislyak, applauded from the front row. He later attended the Republican National Convention, but avoided ours. Republican national security experts were appalled by Trump's embrace of Putin. So was I. At every opportunity, I warned that allowing Trump to be commander-in-chief would be profoundly dangerous and play directly into Russia's hands. It'll be like Christmas in the Kremlin, I predicted. Breach. Then things got stranger. In late March 2016, FBI agents met with my campaign lawyer, Mark Elias, and other senior staffers at our Brooklyn headquarters to warn us that foreign hackers could be targeting our campaign with phishing emails that tried to trick people into clicking links or entering passwords that would open up access to our network. We were already aware of the threat because scores, if not hundreds, of these phishing emails were pouring in. Most were easy to spot, and we had no reason at the time to believe any were successful. Then in early June, Mark got a disturbing message from the Democratic National Committee. The DNC's computer network had been penetrated by hackers, thought to be working for the Russian government. According to the New York Times, the FBI had apparently discovered the breach months earlier in September 2015 and had informed a tech support contractor at the DNC, but never visited the office or did much to follow up. As a former head of the FBI cyber division told the Times later, that was a bewildering oversight. Quote, "We are not talking about an office that is in the middle of the woods of Montana," unquote, he said. The offices were just a mile and a half apart. After the election, FBI Director Comey admitted, "I might have walked over there myself, knowing what I know now." Word didn't reach the DNC leadership until April. They then brought in a respected cybersecurity firm called CrowdStrike to figure out what was going on, kick out the hackers, and protect the network from further penetration. The CrowdStrike experts determined that the hackers had likely come from Russia and that they had gained access to a large trove of emails and documents. All of this would become public when the Washington Post broke the story on June 14th. The news was unsettling, but not shocking. The Russian government had been attempting to hack sensitive American networks for years, as had other countries such as China, Iran, and North Korea. In 2014, Russians had breached the State Department's unclassified system and then moved on to the White House and the Pentagon. They also hacked think tanks, journalists, and politicians. The general view was that all of these hacks and attempted hacks were fairly run-of-the-mill intelligence gathering, albeit with 21st-century techniques. That turned out to be wrong. Something far more insidious was happening. On June 15th, one day after the DNC attack became public, a hacker named Guccifer 2.0, thought to be a front for Russian intelligence, claimed credit for the breach and posted a cache of stolen documents. He said he had given thousands more to WikiLeaks, the organization supposedly devoted to radical transparency. Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, promised to release, quote, emails related to Hillary Clinton, unquote, although it wasn't at all clear what that meant. The publication of stolen files from the DNC was a dramatic turn of events for several reasons. For starters, it showed that Russia was interested in doing more than collecting intelligence on the American political scene. It was actively trying to influence the election. Just as it had done a year earlier with the audio recording of Toria Nuland, Russia was weaponizing stolen information. It did not occur to me at the time that anyone associated with Donald Trump might be coordinating with the Russians, but it seemed likely that Putin was trying to help his preferred candidate. After all, he disliked and feared me and had an ally in Trump. This was underscored when the Trump campaign removed language from the Republican Party platform calling for the United States to provide Ukraine with lethal defensive weapons, a gift to Putin that might as well have come with a ribbon and a bow. Careful analysis of the documents from Guccifer also revealed an alarming prospect. At least one of the files seemed like it could have come from our campaign, not the DNC. Further research suggested that the file might have been stolen from the personal Gmail account of John Podesta, my campaign chairman. We couldn't be sure, but we feared that more trouble was coming. Shouting into the wind. On July 22nd, WikiLeaks published about 20,000 stolen DNC emails. It highlighted a handful of messages that included offensive comments about Bernie Sanders, which predictably set off a firestorm among Bernie's supporters, many of whom were still angry about having lost the primaries. But nothing in the stolen emails remotely backed up the charge that the primaries had been rigged. Nearly all of the offending messages were written in May, months after I had amassed an insurmountable vote and delegate lead. More important, though, was the fact that the Russians or their proxies had the sophistication to find and exploit those handful of provocative stolen emails in order to drive a wedge between Democrats. That suggests a deep knowledge and familiarity of our political scene and its players. Also, imagine how many inflammatory and embarrassing things they would have found if they'd hacked Republican targets. Spoiler alert, they did, but never released anything. The timing of the WikiLeaks release was terrible, and it didn't seem like a coincidence. I had defeated Bernie and locked up the nomination in early June, but he hadn't endorsed me until July 12th, and now we were working hard to bring the party together before the Democratic National Convention started in Philadelphia on July 25th. Plus, the news hit on the same day I was introducing Tim Kaine as my running mate, turning what should have been one of the best days of our campaign into a circus. The document dump seemed designed to cause us maximum damage at a critical moment. It worked. DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz resigned 2 days later, and the opening of the convention was marred by loud boos and catcalls from Sanders supporters. I was sick about the whole thing. After so many long, hard months of campaigning, I wanted the convention to be perfect. It was my best chance until the debates to present my vision for the country directly to the voters. I remembered what a boost Bill received from his convention in Madison Square Garden in 1992, and I hoped to gain similar momentum. Instead, we were now dealing with a divided party and distracted press corps. Democratic leaders, especially Congresswoman Marsha Fudge of Ohio, Reverend Leah Daughtry, and Donna Brazile helped bring order to the chaos. And Michelle Obama's masterful, moving speech brought the hall together and quieted the dissenters. Then Bernie spoke, endorsed me again, and helped cement the détente. On July 27th, the day before I formally accepted the Democratic nomination, Trump held one of his wild, stream-of-consciousness press conferences. He said that as president, he might accept Russia's annexation of Crimea, deflected blame from the Kremlin for the DNC hack, and then remarkably urged the Russians to try to hack my email account. Quote, Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing, unquote, he said, referring to the personal, non-work-related emails that were deleted from my account after everything else had been provided to the State Department. Quote, I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press, unquote. As the New York Times described it, Trump was, quote, urging a power often hostile to the United States to violate American law by breaking into a private computer network, unquote. Katie Turr of NBC News followed up to see if this was a joke or he really meant it. She asked if Trump had any qualms about asking a foreign government to break into Americans' emails. Instead of backing off, he doubled down. Quote, if Russia or China or any other country has those emails, I mean, to be honest with you, I'd love to see them, unquote, he said. He also refused to tell Putin not to try to interfere in the election. Quote, I'm not going to tell Putin what to do. Why should I tell Putin what to do? Unquote. This was no joke. Despite Trump's attempts to cover for Putin, cybersecurity experts and U.S. intelligence officers were confident that the Russians were behind the hack. There still wasn't official consensus about whether their goal was to undermine public confidence in America's democratic institutions or if Putin was actively trying to derail my candidacy and help elect Trump. But I didn't have any doubt. And the timing of the public disclosure, as well as the specific nature of the material, did Russian intelligence really understand the ins and outs of DNC politics and the decisions of Debbie Wasserman Schultz? Raised the strong possibility that the Russians had gotten help from someone with experience in American politics, a truly alarming prospect. We were doing a million things at once that week. The convention was all-consuming, so it was hard to stop and focus on the gravity of what was happening. But I realized we had crossed a line. This wasn't the normal rough and tumble of politics. This was, there's no other word for it, war. I told my team I thought we were at a break glass moment. We're under attack, I said. It was time to take a much more aggressive public posture. Robbie Mook did a round of interviews in which he pointed the finger squarely at Russia. He said they weren't trying just to create chaos. They were actively trying to help Trump. That shouldn't have been particularly controversial, but Robbie was treated like a kook. Jennifer Palmieri and Jake Sullivan held a series of background briefings for news networks to explain in more detail. After the election, Jennifer wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post titled, "The Clinton Campaign Warned You About Russia, But Nobody Listened to Us." She recalled how journalists were generally more interested in the gossipy content of the stolen emails rather than the prospect that a foreign power was trying to manipulate our election. The press treated our warnings about Russia like it was spin we'd cooked up to distract from embarrassing revelations, a view actively encouraged by the Trump campaign. The media was accustomed to Trump peddling crazy conspiracy theories, like that Ted Cruz's dad helped kill John F. Kennedy. And it acted as if the Russian hacking was our conspiracy theory, a tidy false equivalency that let reporters and pundits sleep well at night. As Matt Iglesias of the news site Vox described it later, most journalists thought the argument that Moscow was trying to help Trump was, quote, outlandish and borderline absurd, unquote, and our attempt to raise the alarm was, quote, just too aggressive, self-serving, and a little far-fetched, unquote. Maybe the press wouldn't listen to us, but I figured they would listen to respected intelligence officials. On August 5th, Mike Morrell, the former acting director of the CIA, wrote a highly unusual op-ed in the New York Times. Despite being a strictly nonpartisan career professional, he said that he had decided to endorse me for president because of my strong record on national security, including my role in bringing Osama bin Laden to justice. By contrast, he said Trump was, quote, not only unqualified for the job, but he may well pose a threat to our national security, unquote. Coming from America's former top spy, that was a shocking statement, but it paled compared with what Morrell said next. Putin, he noted, was a career intelligence officer, quote, trained to identify vulnerabilities in an individual and to exploit them, unquote. And here's the shocking part. Quote, in the intelligence business, Morrell said, we would say that Mr. Putin had recruited Mr. Trump as an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation, unquote. Morrell's argument was not that Trump or his campaign was conspiring illegally with the Russians to rig the election, although he certainly didn't rule it out. It was that Putin was manipulating Trump into taking policy positions that would help Russia and hurt America, including, quote, endorsing Russian espionage against the United States, supporting Russia's annexation of Crimea, and giving a green light to a possible Russian invasion of the Baltic states, unquote. That's an important point to keep in mind, because it often gets lost amid the intense focus on potential criminal acts. Even without a secret conspiracy, there was plenty of troubling pro-Putin behavior right out in the open. Morrell's op-ed was the equivalent of pulling the fire alarm in a crowded building. And yet, somehow, most in the media and many voters continued to ignore the danger staring us in the face. Snakes. I was not shocked to see the connection between WikiLeaks and the Russian intelligence services. At least that helped further discredit its odious leader, Julian Assange. In my view, Assange is a hypocrite who deserves to be held accountable for his actions. He claims to be a champion of transparency, but for many years, he's been helpful to Putin, one of the most repressive and least transparent autocrats in the world. It's not just that WikiLeaks avoids publishing anything Putin won't like and instead targets Russia's adversaries. Assange actually hosted a television show on RT, Putin's propaganda network, and receives adoring coverage there. And if hypocrisy isn't bad enough, Assange was charged with rape in Sweden. To avoid facing those charges, he jumped bail and fled to the Ecuadorian embassy in London. After years of waiting, Sweden eventually said it would no longer try to extradite him, but promised that if Assange came back to the country, the investigation could be reopened. Assange, like Putin, has held a grudge against me for a long time. The bad blood goes back to 2010, when WikiLeaks published more than 250,000 stolen State Department cables, including many sensitive observations from our diplomats in the field. As Secretary of State, I was responsible for the safety of our officers around the world, and I knew that releasing those confidential reports put not only them in danger, but also their foreign contacts, including human rights activists and dissidents who could face reprisals from their own governments. We had to move fast to evacuate vulnerable people, and thankfully, we don't believe anyone was killed or jailed as a result. I thought Assange was reckless and wrong and said so publicly. The fact that these two old adversaries from my time as Secretary of State, Assange and Putin, seemed to be working together to damage my campaign was maddening. It was bad enough to have to go up against a billionaire opponent and the entire Republican Party. Now I also had to take on these nefarious outside forces. The journalist, Rebecca Traister, observed once that there was, quote, an Indiana Jones style. It had to be Snake's inevitability about me facing Trump. Quote, of course Hillary Clinton is going to have to run against a man who seems both to embody and have attracted the support of everything male, white, and angry about the ascension of women and black people in America, unquote, she wrote. I was up for the challenge, and I might add, of course, I had to face not just one America-bashing misogynist, but three. Of course, I'd have to get by Putin and Assange as well. By midsummer 2016, the whole world knew that Trump and his team were cheering on the Russian attack on our democracy and doing everything they could to exploit it. Trump never even tried to hide the fact that he was making common cause with Putin. But what if they were doing more than that? What if they were actually conspiring with Russian intelligence and WikiLeaks? There wasn't any evidence of that yet, but the coincidences were piling up. Then on August 8th, Trump's longtime consigliere, Roger Stone, who cut his teeth as one of Richard Nixon's dirty tricksters, bragged to a group of Florida Republicans that he was in communication with Assange and predicted that an October surprise was coming. This was a shocking admission, made in public from Trump's longest-serving political advisor. Stone made similar statements on August 12th, 14th, 15th, and 18th. On August 21st, he tweeted, "Trust me, it will soon be Podesta's time in the barrel, hashtag Crooked Hillary." This was particularly notable because, as I mentioned earlier, we had determined there was a good chance that John's email might have been hacked, but didn't know for sure. Stone kept at it over the next few weeks, even calling Assange his hero. I wasn't the only one who noticed. At the end of August, Harry Reid, one of the Congressional Gang of Eight, who are briefed on the most sensitive intelligence matters, wrote a letter to FBI Director Comey that cited Stone's claims and asked for a full and thorough investigation. Quote, "The evidence of a direct connection between the Russian government and Donald Trump's presidential campaign continues to mount," unquote, Reid wrote. He also raised the prospect that there might be an attempt to falsify official election results. This was a reference to public reports that Russian hackers had penetrated voter registration databases in both Arizona and Illinois, prompting the FBI to warn state election officials across the country to upgrade their security. Like Morrell's op-ed, Reid's letter was an attempt to shake the country out of its complacency and get the press, the administration, and all Americans focused on an urgent threat. It didn't work. Drip, drip, drip. As we headed into the fall, troubling reports and rumors continued to swirl. Paul Manafort resigned on August 19th amid growing questions about his financial ties to Russia. On September 5th, The Washington Post reported that U.S. intelligence agencies now believed there was, quote, a broad covert Russian operation in the United States to sow public distrust in the upcoming presidential election and in U.S. political institutions, unquote. That meant it was much bigger than the DNC hack. We heard there was a federal interagency task force digging into the Trump team's financial ties, but no reporters could get it confirmed on the record. There was also talk that the FBI was looking into strange computer traffic between Trump Tower and a Russian bank. Reporters were chasing that one, too, and Slate's Franklin Four eventually broke the story on October 31st. Then there were whispers going around Washington that the Russians had compromising information on Trump, possibly a salacious videotape from a Moscow hotel, but nobody had any proof. At my first debate with Trump on September 26th, I went after him hard on Russia, and he continued to defend Putin and contradict the conclusions of our intelligence agencies, which they had shared with him personally. Quote, I don't think anybody knows it was Russia that broke into the DNC, Trump insisted. I mean, it could be Russia, but it could also be China. It could also be lots of other people. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds, okay? Unquote. What was he talking about? A 400-pound guy in his basement? Was he thinking of a character out of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo? I wondered who told Trump to say that. Meanwhile, Roger Stone continued to tweet warnings that WikiLeaks was preparing to drop another bomb on us, one that would destroy my campaign and land me in prison. He was such a bizarre character, it was hard to know how seriously to take anything he said. But given what had happened already, who knew what other dirty tricks were coming our way? Then came October 7th, one of the most significant days of the entire campaign. I was in a prep session for the upcoming second debate, trying hard to stay focused on the task at hand. The first thing that happened was that Jim Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, and Jay Johnson, the Secretary of Homeland Security, issued a brief statement that for the first time formally accused Russia's senior-most officials of ordering the hacking of the DNC. We already knew this, but the formal statement gave it the full weight of the U.S. government. Strikingly, the FBI did not join in the statement, and we later learned that Comey refused to do so, claiming it was inappropriate so close to the election. Then at 4 p.m., the Washington Post broke the news of Trump's Access Hollywood tape, in which he bragged about sexually assaulting women. It was a catastrophe for Trump's campaign. Less than 1 hour later, WikiLeaks announced it had obtained 50,000 of John Podesta's emails and published a first batch of about 2,000. It looked like an orchestrated attempt to change the subject and distract voters, and provided further reason to believe that WikiLeaks and its Russian patrons were very much in sync with the Trump campaign. It turns out Russian hackers had gained access to John's personal email account back in March, thanks to a successful phishing attack. WikiLeaks continued to release stolen emails almost every single day for the rest of the campaign. For a while, it seemed like the WikiLeaks gambit was failing. The Access Hollywood story dominated the headlines, put Trump on the defensive, and sent his Republican backers scurrying for cover. The press eagerly covered every stolen email that emerged, even reprinting John's favorite risotto recipe. But none of the stories monopolized the news cycle like the Trump tape. I commiserated with John about the outrageous invasion of privacy. I was one of the few who knew what it felt like, but he took it in stride. He felt bad about some of the language he used. He felt even worse for the friends and colleagues who had sent him private messages and now had to see their words printed for all to see. And WikiLeaks hadn't bothered to redact personal information such as phone numbers and social security numbers, which victimized good people who deserved better. In the end, though, most of John's emails were boring. They revealed the nuts and bolts of a campaign at work, with staffers debating policies, editing speeches, and kibitzing about the daily ups and downs of the election. In fact, Tom Friedman of the New York Times wrote a column about how well the behind-the-scenes correspondence reflected on me and my team. Quote, when I read Wiki Hillary, I hear a smart, pragmatic, center-left politician, he wrote, and I am more convinced than ever she can be the president America needs today, unquote. What was harder to see at the time was that the steady stream of stories guaranteed that Clinton and emails remained in the headlines up until Election Day. None of this had anything at all to do with my use of personal email at the State Department, nothing at all. But for many voters, it would all blend together. And that was before Jim Comey sent his misguided letter to Congress, which made it all much worse. As a result, we faced a perfect storm, and Trump did his best to amplify our problems, citing WikiLeaks more than 160 times in the final month of the campaign. He could barely contain his excitement whenever a new batch of stolen emails appeared. Comparing the effects of WikiLeaks and Access Hollywood may prove the old Washington cliche about how the drip-drip of scandal can be even more damaging over time than a single really bad story. Trump's tape was like a bomb going off, and the damage was immediate and severe. But no other tapes emerged, so there was nowhere else for the story to go. Eventually, the press and the public moved on. It's amazing how quickly the media metabolism works these days. By contrast, the WikiLeaks email dumps kept coming and coming. It was like Chinese water torture. No single day was that bad, but it added up, and we could never get past it. WikiLeaks played into people's fascination with pulling back the curtain. Anything said behind closed doors is automatically considered more interesting, important, and honest than things said in public. It's even better if you have to do a little legwork and Google around for the information. We sometimes joke that if we wanted the press to pay attention to our jobs plan, which I talked about endlessly to little avail, we should leak a private email about it. Only then would it be news worth covering. WikiLeaks also helped accelerate the phenomenon that eventually came to be known as fake news. False storylines started appearing on Facebook, Reddit, Breitbart, Drudge Report, and other sites, often claiming to be based on stolen emails. For example, WikiLeaks tweeted on November 6th that the Clinton Foundation paid for Chelsea's wedding, a totally false accusation, as the Washington Post's Glenn Kessler later verified in his fact-checker column. Kessler, who's never been shy about criticizing me, heard from readers who said this lie helped convince them to vote for Trump. After the election, he investigated and found it to be, quote, a claim lacking any evidence, unquote, and he urged readers, quote, to be more careful consumers of the news, unquote. The lack of evidence didn't stop the New York Post and Fox News from repeating the lie and giving it mass circulation. That really got under my skin. Bill and I were proud to pay for Chelsea's and Mark's wedding, and we treasure every memory of it. Lies about me and Bill are one thing, but I can't stand to see lies about Chelsea. She doesn't deserve that. Russia's propaganda networks, RT and Sputnik, were eager purveyors of fake news. For example, U.S. intelligence agencies later pointed to an August 2016 video produced by RT titled, quote, how 100% of the Clintons' charity went to themselves, unquote. It was another lie. Since Bill and I have released our tax returns going back decades, it's public record that since 2001, we've donated more than $23 million to charities such as the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation, educational institutions, hospitals, churches, the Children's Defense Fund, and the Clinton Foundation. And none of us, not Bill, not Chelsea, not me, has ever taken any money from the foundation. At the time, I was barely aware that such silly Russian smears were circulating on American social media. And yet, according to a U.S. intelligence assessment, that one RT video alone was viewed more than 9 million times, mostly on Facebook. Even if I had known that, it would have been hard to believe that many voters would take any of it seriously. Still, reporting from BuzzFeed and others was finding that the reach of fake news on Facebook and other outlets was far wider than anyone expected, and that much of it was being generated in faraway countries such as Macedonia. The whole thing was bizarre, and Trump did all he could to help fake news spread and take root, repeating fake headlines from Russian propaganda outlets like Sputnik at his rallies and retweeting extremist memes. The day before the election, President Obama was campaigning for me in Michigan. Yes, we campaigned in Michigan. And he expressed the frustration we all felt. Quote, as long as it's on Facebook and people can see it, as long as it's on social media, people start believing it, he said, and it creates this dust cloud of nonsense, unquote. Nonsense was right. On October 30th, Harry Reid wrote another letter to Jim Comey, trying one last time to focus the nation's attention back on the unprecedented foreign intervention in our election. The former boxer from Searchlight, Nevada, knew we were in the fight of our lives, and he couldn't believe no one was paying attention. Harry had been briefed by intelligence officials and was frustrated they weren't informing the American people about what was really going on. Quote, it has become clear that you possess explosive information about close ties and coordination between Donald Trump, his top advisors, and the Russian government, he wrote to Comey. The public has a right to know this information, unquote. And yet Comey, who was only too eager to speak publicly about the investigation into my emails, continued to refuse to say a word about Trump and Russia. I was worried that we'd see even more direct tampering on Election Day. But what more could we do? My campaign and I had spent months shouting into the wind. All that was left was to make our strongest case to voters and hope for the best. Dragnet. After the election, I tried to unplug, avoid the news, and not think too much about all this. But the universe didn't cooperate. Just 4 days after the election, the Russian deputy foreign minister bragged in an interview that his government had contacts with Trump's immediate entourage during the campaign. Both the Kremlin and Trump's people tried to walk back this remarkable admission, but the bell couldn't be unrung. A few days after that, President Obama ordered the intelligence community, the collection of the government's 17 different intelligence agencies, to conduct a full review into Russian interference into the election. Then in early December, a 28-year-old man from North Carolina drove to Washington, D.C. with a Colt AR-15 assault rifle, a .38 caliber Colt revolver, and a knife. He had read on the internet that a popular local Washington pizzeria was secretly hosting a child sex abuse ring run by John Podesta and me. This particularly disgusting fake news got its start with an innocuous email released by WikiLeaks about John going out for pizza. It was quickly refracted through the dark corners of the internet and emerged as a blood-curdling conspiracy theory. Alex Jones, the right-wing talk show host, effusively praised by Trump, who claims that 9/11 was an inside job and the Sandy Hook massacre was a hoax, recorded a YouTube video about, quote, all the children Hillary Clinton has personally murdered and chopped up and raped, unquote. Soon that young man from North Carolina was in his car on his way to Washington. When he got to the pizzeria, he searched everywhere for the children supposedly being held captive. There weren't any. He fired off one shot before being apprehended by police and eventually sentenced to 4 years in prison. Thankfully, no one was harmed. I was horrified. I immediately contacted a friend of mine who runs a bookstore on the same street. She told me that her employees also had been harassed and threatened by conspiracy nuts. In early January, the intelligence community reported back to President Obama and published an unclassified version of its findings for the public. The headline was that Putin himself had ordered a covert operation with the goal of denigrating and defeating me, electing Trump, and undermining the American people's faith in the democratic process. That was no surprise to me or anyone else who had been paying attention, although it was notable that it was now the official view of the U.S. government. The real news, however, was that the Russian intervention had gone far beyond hacking email accounts and releasing files. Moscow had waged sophisticated information warfare on a massive scale, manipulating social media and flooding it with propaganda and fake news. Soon it felt like every day there was a new revelation about the scope of the Russian operation, secret contacts with the Trump campaign, and an ongoing federal investigation digging into all of it. Congressional hearings began. The New York Times and the Washington Post competed to break scoop after scoop. I know I give the press a lot of grief, especially the Times, but this really was journalism at its finest. I wasn't just a former candidate trying to figure out why she lost. I was also a former Secretary of State worried about our nation's national security. I couldn't resist following every twist and turn of the story as closely as possible. I read everything I could get my hands on. I called friends in Washington and Silicon Valley and consulted with national security experts and seasoned Russia hands. I learned more than I ever imagined about algorithms, content farms, and search engine optimization. The voluminous file of clippings on my desk grew thicker and thicker. To keep it all straight, I started making lists of everything we knew about the unfolding scandal. At times I felt like CIA agent Carrie Matheson on the TV show Homeland, desperately trying to get her arms around a sinister conspiracy and appearing more than a little frantic in the process. That's not a good look for anyone, let alone a former Secretary of State. So instead, let me channel a TV show that I grew up watching as a kid in Park Ridge, Dragnet. Just the facts, ma'am. We've learned a lot about what the Russians did, what the Trump campaign did, and how the U.S. government responded. Let's go through it step by step. What the feds did. First, we've learned that the federal investigation started much earlier than was publicly known. In late 2015, European intelligence agencies picked up contacts between Trump associates and Russian intelligence operatives. Communications intercepts by U.S. and allied intelligence seem to have continued throughout 2016. We now know that by July 2016, the FBI's elite National Security Division in Washington had started investigating whether the Trump campaign and the Russians were coordinating to influence the election. They have also been looking into Paul Manafort's financial ties to pro-Putin oligarchs. In the summer of 2016, according to the Washington Post, the FBI convinced a special foreign intelligence surveillance court that there was probable cause to believe that Trump advisor Carter Page was acting as a Russian agent, and they received a warrant to monitor his communications. The FBI also began investigating a dossier prepared by a well-respected former British spy that contained explosive and salacious allegations about compromising information the Russians had on Trump. The intelligence community took the dossier seriously enough that it briefed both President Obama and President-elect Trump on its contents before the inauguration. By the spring of 2017, a federal grand jury was issuing subpoenas to business associates of Michael Flynn, who resigned as Trump's national security advisor after lying about his Russian contacts. We've also learned a lot about how various parts of the U.S. government reacted differently to the intelligence coming in over the course of 2016 about ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. The CIA seems to have been most alarmed and was also convinced that the Russian goal was to help Trump and hurt me. As early as August 2016, CIA Director John Brennan called his counterpart in Moscow and warned him to stop interfering in the election. Brennan also individually briefed the Gang of Eight congressional leaders and shared his concerns. This explains why Harry Reid sought to galvanize public attention on the threat in his August letter. We've learned that the FBI took a different approach. They launched an investigation in July 2016, but Director Comey didn't inform congressional leaders, was slower than Brennan to come to the conclusion that Russia's goal was electing Trump, and refused to join other intelligence agencies in issuing a joint statement on October 7th because he didn't want to interfere close to an election, something that certainly didn't stop him when it came to trumpeting news about the investigation into my emails. Sources within the FBI also convinced the New York Times to run a story saying they saw, quote, no clear link to Russia, unquote, countering Franklin Foer's scoop in Slate about unusual computer traffic between Trump Tower and a Russian bank. This is one of the stories the Times' ombudsman later criticized. It wasn't until after the election that the FBI finally came around and joined the rest of the intelligence community in putting out the January 2017 assessment that Russia had, in fact, been actively helping Trump. And in March 2017, Comey finally confirmed the existence of a federal investigation into possible coordination. Tyrone Gale, one of my former communications aides, summed up how most of us felt hearing the news. Quote, that sound you just heard was every ex-Clinton staffer banging their heads on the wall from California to D.C., unquote. Part of the frustration was knowing that the FBI's silence had helped Putin succeed and that more exposure could have given the American people the information they needed. While Brennan and Reid had their hair on fire and Comey was dragging his feet, Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell was actively playing defense for Trump and the Russians. We know now that even after he was fully briefed by the CIA, McConnell rejected the intelligence and warned the Obama administration that if it made any attempt to inform the public, he would attack it for playing politics. I can't think of a more shameful example of a national leader so blatantly putting partisanship over national security. McConnell knew better, but he did it anyway. I know some former administration officials have regrets about how this all unfolded. Former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson told the House Intelligence Committee in June 2017 that the administration didn't take a more aggressive public stance because it was concerned about reinforcing Trump's complaints that the election was rigged and being perceived as taking sides in the election. Former Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes, whom I'd come to trust and value when we worked together in President Obama's first term, told the Washington Post that the Obama administration was focused on a traditional cyber threat, while, quote, the Russians were playing this much bigger game, unquote, of multifaceted information warfare. Quote, we weren't able to put all of those pieces together in real time, unquote, Ben said. Mike McFaul, Obama's former ambassador to Russia, summed it up in a concise tweet. Fact, Russia violated our sovereignty during the 2016 election. Fact, Obama exposed that attack. Opinion, we should have focused on it more. I understand the predicament the Obama administration faced, with McConnell threatening them and everyone assuming I was going to win regardless. Richard Clark, President George W. Bush's top counterterrorism advisor on 9/11, has written about how hard it can be to heed warnings about threats that have never been seen before, and certainly it was hard to imagine the Russians would dare to conduct such a massive and unprecedented covert operation. And President Obama did privately warn Putin directly to back off. I do wonder sometimes about what would have happened if President Obama had made a televised address to the nation in the fall of 2016, warning that our democracy was under attack. Maybe more Americans would have woken up to the threat in time. We'll never know. But what we do know for sure is that McConnell and other Republican leaders did everything they could to leave Americans in the dark and vulnerable to attack. What the Trump team did. Let's look at what we've learned since the election about the actions of the Trump team. We know now there were many contacts during the campaign and the transition between Trump associates and Russians, in person, on the phone, and via text and email. Many of these interactions were with Ambassador Kislyak, who was thought to help oversee Russian intelligence operations in the United States, but they included other Russian officials and agents as well. For example, Roger Stone, the longtime Trump political advisor who claimed that he was in touch with Julian Assange, suggested in August 2016 that information about John Podesta was going to come out. In October, Stone hinted Assange and WikiLeaks were going to release something that would be damaging to my campaign, and later admitted to also exchanging direct messages over Twitter with Guccifer 2.0, the front for Russian intelligence, after some of those messages were published by the website The Smoking Gun. We also know now that in December 2016, Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, Jared Kushner, met with Sergei Gorkov, the head of a Kremlin-controlled bank that is under U.S. sanctions and tied closely to Russian intelligence. The Washington Post caused a sensation with its report that Russian officials were discussing a proposal by Kushner to use Russian diplomatic facilities in America to communicate secretly with Moscow. The New York Times reported that Russian intelligence attempted to recruit Carter Page, the Trump foreign policy advisor, as a spy back in 2013. According to the report, the FBI believed Page did not know that the man who approached him was a spy. And according to Yahoo News, U.S. officials received intelligence reports that Carter Page met with a top Putin aide involved with intelligence. Some Trump advisors failed to disclose or lied about their contacts with the Russians, including on applications for security clearances, which could be a federal crime. Attorney General Jeff Sessions lied to Congress about his contacts and later recused himself from the investigation. Michael Flynn lied about being in contact with Kislyak and then changed his story about whether they discussed dropping U.S. sanctions. Reporting since the election has made clear that Trump and his top advisors have little or no interest in learning about the Russian covert operation against American democracy. Trump himself repeatedly called the whole thing a hoax, and at the same time blamed Obama for not doing anything about it. As recently as July 2017, he continued to denigrate the intelligence community and claim that countries other than Russia might be responsible for the DNC hack. Former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates tweeted in response that Trump's, quote, inexplicable refusal to confirm Russian election interference insults career intel pros and hinders our ability to prevent in future, unquote. But there is one area where Trump's team seems to have been intently interested, rolling back U.S. sanctions against Russia. That's what Flynn was discussing with the Russian ambassador. The Reuters news service reported that Senate investigators want to know whether Kushner discussed it in his meetings as well, including whether Russian banks would offer financial support to Trump associates and organizations in return. And as soon as the Trump team took control of the State Department, it started working on a plan to lift sanctions and return to Russia two compounds in Maryland and New York that the Obama administration had confiscated because they were bases for espionage. Career diplomats at state were so concerned that they alerted Congress. As of this writing, the Trump administration is exploring returning the compounds without any preconditions. All of this is significant because it makes it a lot easier to see how a quid pro quo with Russia might have worked. We'll surely continue to learn more, but based on what's already in the public domain, we know that Trump and his team publicly cheered on the Russian operation and took maximum advantage of it. In so doing, they not only encouraged, but actually helped along this attack on our democracy by a hostile foreign power. What the Russians did. That brings us to what we've learned since the election about what the Russians did. We know already about the hacking and release of stolen messages via WikiLeaks, but that's just one part of a much larger effort. It turns out they also hacked the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and fed damaging information to local bloggers and reporters in various congressional districts across the country, which required sophistication. And that's just the beginning. The Official Intelligence Community report explained that the Russian propaganda strategy blends covert intelligence operations, such as cyber activity, with overt efforts by Russian government agencies, state-funded media, third-party intermediaries, and paid social media users, or trolls. Let's try to break down what it all means. The simplest part is traditional state-run media. In this case, Russian networks such as RT and Sputnik. They use their global reach to push Kremlin talking points over the airwaves and social media, including malicious headlines like Clinton and ISIS funded by same money. Sputnik frequently used the same Twitter hashtag as Trump, hashtag Crooked Hillary. It's hard to know exactly how wide of a reach RT has. A Daily Beast article reported on claims that it had exaggerated its stats. It's probably more than you'd think, maybe hundreds of thousands, but not enough that it would have a big impact on an election by itself. But when RT propaganda gets picked up and repeated by American media outlets such as Fox News, Breitbart, and Alex Jones's InfoWars, and posted on Facebook, its reach expands dramatically. That happened frequently during the campaign. Trump and his team also helped amplify Russian stories, giving them an even bigger megaphone. The Russians also generated propaganda in less traditional ways, including thousands of fake news sites and individual internet trolls who posted attacks on Facebook and Twitter. As the intelligence community reported, Russia used trolls as well as RT as part of its influence efforts to denigrate Secretary Clinton. Some social media accounts that appear to be tied to Russia's professional trolls because they previously were devoted to supporting Russian actions in Ukraine started to advocate for President-elect Trump as early as December 2015. Some of the stories created by trolls were blatantly false, like the one about the Pope endorsing Trump. But others were simply misleading attacks on me or puff pieces about Trump. Much of this content was then fed into the same amplification process, pushed along by RT, and then picked up by American outlets such as Fox. The Russians wanted to be sure that impressionable voters in key swing states actually saw their propaganda, so they set out to game the internet. Much of what we see online is governed by a series of algorithms that determine what content appears in our Facebook and Twitter feeds, Google search results, and so on. One factor for these algorithms is popularity. If lots of users share the same post or click on the same link, and if key influencers with large personal networks do as well, then it's more likely to pop up on your screen. To manipulate this process, the Russians flooded the zone with a vast network of fake Twitter and Facebook accounts, some carefully designed to appear like American swing voters. Some of these accounts were run by trolls, live people, and others were automated, but the goal was the same, to artificially boost the volume and popularity of Russian and right-wing propaganda. The automated accounts are called bots, short for robots. The Russians were not the only ones using them, but they took it to a whole other level. Researchers at the University of Southern California have found that nearly 20% of all political tweets sent between September 16th and October 21st, 2016, were generated by bots. Many of them probably were Russian. These tactics, according to Senator Mark Warner, vice chair of the Intelligence Committee, could overwhelm search engines so that the voters' news feeds started showing headlines like Hillary Clinton sick or Hillary Clinton stealing money from the State Department. According to Facebook, another key tactic is the creation of fake affinity groups or community pages that could drive conversation online and draw in unwitting users. Imagine, for example, a fake Black Lives Matter group created to push malicious attacks linking Democrats to the KKK and slavery with the goal of driving down African American turnout. The Russians did things like that. The similarity of their attacks to organic right-wing memes helped. For example, a prominent Trump supporter and evangelical bishop, Aubrey Shines, produced an online video attacking me because Democrats, quote, gave this country slavery, the KKK, Jim Crow laws, unquote. This charge was hugely amplified by the conservative media company Sinclair Broadcast Group, which distributed it to all of its 173 local television stations across the country, along with other right-wing propaganda. Sinclair is now poised to grow to 223 stations. It would reach an estimated 72% of American households. When I learned about these fake groups spreading across Facebook and poisoning our country's political dialogue, I couldn't help but think about the millions of my supporters who felt so bullied and harassed on the Internet that they made sure their online communities, such as Pantsuit Nation, were private. They deserved better, and so did our country. Put all this together, and you've got multifaceted information warfare. Senator Mark Warner summed it up well, quote,